I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the Great American Ballpark in the heart of downtown Cincinnati overlooking the Ohio River. Come along and join me for a most insightful conversation with Karen Forgas, the Cincinnati Reds Senior Vice President of Business Operations. We're in the stands watching the Cincinnati Reds play the San Diego Padres. And as insiders note, the game of baseball is a most social event, and the local community is among the most ardent, loyal fans of any professional team in America. Come along and join Forgas to discover fascinating insights about the backstory of the Cincinnati Reds and how the team engages with the community. They do an incredibly brilliant job incubating and nurturing the upcoming generation to become passionate, lifelong Reds fans. The team commences their engagement with kids right after they're born.
Babies, when they're born and they leave the hospital, they have an automatic free membership to the Reds Rookies Club. And then they get a free ticket to their first game that year. Mom and Dad get to parade them on the field.
And the engagement continues nonstop as they grow up.
This is Great American Ballpark, which, if you think about it, is probably the perfect name for a baseball park in the United States of America. The Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, Ohio, home of the Cincinnati Reds.
Going back to right after the Civil War, oldest ball club in America.
It is, and you know, back in those days, Cincinnati was the seventh or eighth largest city. Because of the Ohio River, a lot of German immigrants came over, you know, out of Bavaria at that time. And baseball was being played as kind of a social thing. It was something people did after their day jobs, and it was people were outside because it was hot, and people would bring picnics, so it was kind of a social thing. And two really energetic entrepreneurial brothers, the Wright brothers, not the airplane Wright brothers. One of them was really good at baseball, and one of them was a really good businessman. And he got to seeing that people gathered in scale to watch baseball. So in 1868, he posted in the big cities like New York and Boston and Philadelphia that he was going to pay for people to play baseball as their profession. So they had to come to Cincinnati, they had to try out, and he formed the first professional baseball team for 1869. Now, a couple cool things. They were contracted, and one of the things that the contract required was decorum off the field, and they also had to commit to practice. He did two genius things that made this stick. Number one, he contracted a woman who lived in the downtown area from Prussia who made costumes. He was kind of inspired by the circuses of the time, so they actually made matching uniforms with red stockings, hence they were called the Cincinnati Red Stockings, so they were in matching uniforms. But the real genius was he employed a couple riders, just like you. These riders would come travel with the Red Stockings and also advance the Red Stockings. They barnstormed in 1869 throughout all the other big cities on the East Coast. I think they went 57-0. They would come into a town for 3 days. People would come in droves to watch them play. Whoever came to watch, you know, they would challenge who's ever in the city who wanted to play them. And then, of course, like all good ideas, the minute they would leave Philadelphia, they posted up a sign they were going to field a professional team next year. So that's how baseball got started in the United States.
Right here in Cincinnati. I love it.
It's really great. So here we sit in 2024, you know, and thank you for coming to visit, because the challenge today, as you know, we still have the same finite amount of time, 24 hours in a day, and everybody's got so many things that they can do with their time. So our challenge is to really understand where baseball fits in for people. And as you look around here tonight, you've got date night going on. You've got some business people here because it's a business day. So we've really had to try to figure out how to put together a couple hours around a baseball game that people would come and have fun. And so it's a totally different business than it was back then.
What's interesting is you guys have to keep the game economically viable. And to do that, you have to engage the kids. How do you do that?
we're one of the few teams, we have a $5 ticket still. You're also allowed to bring in your own food. You can bring in your own unopened water. So we try to make it affordable, but of course, that's a very small percentage of the people. Most people, as you see today, and really research contends it's true, is that when people post-COVID, when they're going out, they want to spend money because they want to have an experience. They want to have a good time. So then people are really taking advantage of the best seats. They're buying the best food we have, and they're coming and having fun.
Let's go to the bigger picture, how to keep the game of baseball economically viable and some of the struggles that you go through.
You have 30 different ball clubs in Major League Baseball, and they're in 30 different cities that are all different sizes with different size populations. So that's always difficult to make sure that everybody's got good competition. But I think our team has figured out a very solid baseball model where we scout really well, we develop our players really well, so we can field a very competitive team. According to Nielsen, the 30 baseball teams, we are the 29th market size. That means that the possibility of who could buy tickets is a very small universe. But fortunately for the Cincinnati Reds, where we're located, within our ticket buying population within Major League Baseball, we're closer to 7th because we have a lot of very loyal, generationally tied to the Reds cities around Cincinnati that they consider the Reds their team. So that's really what we have to continue to do, is to make sure we have an excellent fan experience. If somebody gives you the most precious commodity we all have, which is our time, you better make sure that they have fun, because with the front office, I can't control the winning and we can't control the weather. So I have to make sure that people came to the ballpark and had a good, memorable time here.
Let's talk about the bigger picture, the ultimate, which is income and outcome and where your best revenue sources are.
Well, I can tell you that the revenue sources that have the most upside for all professional organizations are ticket sales, because you tend to get a long-term contract for any of your broadcast rights or any other kinds of things tied to the leagues you're in. But your real opportunity is ticket sales, because that increases your revenue from the ticket itself. Then people, you know, buy food and beverages and merchandise while they're there. Plus, the more eyeballs that come in, the more sponsorships you can sell for the signage and the different, you know, sponsored events happening in the ballpark. So that's a lot of our emphasis.
Your management realized that and increased the number of retail outlets immensely around the stadium.
They definitely have. You know, we're fortunate that we have a group of owners here in Cincinnati that all have deep ties to this city. They're very loyal to it, because the Reds' economic impact is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, because we have 81 home events that attract people from up to 7 states. So we have to always be really good stewards of this organization, you know, not just to cover our bills, but to keep the whole city lifted up. And even being on a program like yours, it's just interesting, because people think, yeah, I've got a Major League Baseball team near my house, and they think that's all there is, but every stadium is different, you know, and every fan base is unique. And, you know, these young athletes out there, man, oh man, these guys, they have been working hard to make it. They're living their dream in front of your very eyes. None of them are from Cincinnati.
The kids, how do you reach out and engage with them?
We've created a couple really cool programs that are kids clubs. So the first one is Reds Rookies, and that is for babies that are born up to age 3. We work with there's a hospital chain in town that has 11,000 babies born every year. So those babies, when they're born and they leave the hospital, they have an automatic free membership to the Reds Rookies Club. And then they get a free ticket to their first game that year. Mom and dad get to parade them on the field. Mom and dad claim their future roster spot. They're going to be a shortstop. We give them a signed certificate of a contract from our manager and owner. And then they get a birthday card every year from that player who's the shortstop. And then during the season, they get an opportunity to come and get their picture taken on a player's lap like it's Santa Claus. So that's for the babies club. And then we do the Reds Heads Kids Club, which is 3 to 10 or 11-year-olds. And that's really a lot of swag. It's $30 to join. You get a backpack and a lanyard, free tickets, trading pins. And those kids, again, it's about experiences. They get invited to come to kids-only press conferences. They get to go and run the bases. They get tours of the ballpark. They get private autograph sessions. So we make sure that mom has an easy out. Moms like easy outs. Moms want to make memories. Moms plan in advance, and moms want a good value. So we kind of gear our Reds Heads Kids Club. And then we have 18,000 members in that this year alone. So it's very popular, and that's part of the way we're getting that next generation.
That's really cool. Let's talk a moment about contrast between professional football and baseball, because one, it's just like somebody was saying earlier, the number of games that pro football plays per year versus baseball is?
There are 16 games in a season. We have 162. So there's a lot of demand pressure for the tickets because the supply is limited. The other cool thing for the NFL is that it is not a local sport because there's not that many teams playing games. There's 15 games a week, basically. And they can, with broadcasting, now that they're playing Thursdays through Mondays, they can slot those games so that the whole country can watch any matchup because they're not happening simultaneous. Like as you and I sit here tonight at Great American Ballpark, there are 15 other games happening simultaneously. It's not this week. They're happening in the same three-hour window, basically. The NFL game, I'm in a mob. The MLS game, I'm in a choir. But when you come to a baseball game, people come in twos, threes, fives. You don't really come in here wanting to stand with your whole section. You don't really want to talk to anybody else. You're just with your little insular group. And the pace of the game is such that you get up and leave your seat. You walk around. You would never do that in an NFL game. You would never leave your seat. Or even a hockey game. You know, you don't leave. So this is very much built on companionship. That's good. This is our closer who's just come in, and he just did a very good job getting a strike.
Tell us where to go to learn more about your world.
Go to Reds.com. It's pretty straightforward. And when you get on Reds.com, they can take you to anything from about the ballpark, the players, or how to come and be at a game. We just won a game. I think I need you to come back. You're a good luck charm. My name is Karen Forgas, and I am the Chief Communications and Community Officer for the Cincinnati Reds.
I love it.
Lifelong Cincinnati resident Jeff Birding had a vision. Create a professional soccer team, build a purpose-built stadium, and thus transform the West End community. Birding, along with controlling owner Carl Linder, commenced Cincinnati's professional soccer franchise back in 2015, and they opened the purpose-built 26,000-seat TQL Stadium in 2021, located in Cincinnati's West End neighborhood adjacent to the historic Over the Rhine District. Come along and join me for a fascinating conversation with Jeff Birding, where he shares his passion, enthusiasm, and tenacity for not only bringing professional soccer to the city, but deftly engaging and partnering with the surrounding neighborhood. Discover how Birding's vision is revitalizing and simultaneously empowering the adjacent community with a $300 million multi-phase development to include retail, restaurant, hotel, office, residential, and entertainment spaces. Birding says, "We're a franchise with a mission to give back to the community while uniting people to make the community a better place to live." Jeff Birding.
I'm the co-founder, president, and co-CEO of FC Cincinnati, our Major League Soccer franchise here in Cincinnati.
Let's go back in time in Jeff's life. You grew up here?
I did. I grew up on the west side of Cincinnati, large Catholic family, 10 kids. Ended up going to the Jesuit high school, St. Xavier. Because of St. Xavier, I became the first Birding to go to college, graduate from college, Went to Miami University.
What did you major in?
Soviet studies and political science. I thought I was going to be a diplomat. Studied in Moscow one summer.
Wow.
Came back and after graduating, worked in Ohio House of Representatives and ended up being U.S. Senator John Glenn's state political director in 1992. But
you had no clue that you would go sports.
No. I came back and worked for our local congressman, David Mann. And then I was starting to get my MBA at night and was asked to run the campaign to keep the Reds and Bengals in Cincinnati.
What was the threat?
The threat was that Riverfront Stadium was obsolete. It was falling apart.
And yet it was only like 30 years old.
It opened in 1970.
Wow.
So less than 30 years old. But it had not been kept up. So there was to pass a sales tax to build the Reds and Bengals stadiums and then redevelop the central riverfront downtown. So we were going to use the stadiums as an opportunity to redevelop our riverfront and connect the downtown business district to the riverfront. So I was hired to run the campaign. And then afterwards, it was quite successful, and I was hired to work for the Bengals, and I ended up being there 19 years.
Wow.
Got my MBA at night while I was there, but stayed involved in city affairs, was elected three times to serve on Cincinnati City Council, going door to door, and I really focused on how do we grow our city, how do we lift our city up. We're in competition with other cities for jobs and lifting up the tax base so you have a safety net, but you also have the ability to, you know, have people have jobs. But after 6 years, I decided to trade city hall politics for youth soccer politics. I have three children, two of them were good soccer players.
So it was accidental.
It was very accidental. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Once I got involved with soccer, I sort of do everything full go and became the president of the board, led a merger. And then I was traveling all over the country with my son's team, which was a state cup champion. And you could see the growth of soccer in all these other cities. We're driving an hour from the hotel to the fields because all the hotels are booked.
So there really wasn't any soccer presence
No.
here in town?
None. It had been tried before, but always failed. Mm-hmm. I started writing a business plan because I wanted my children to have a hometown team and the sport they love. Because when I was growing up, I knew Cincinnati was the best city in the country because we had the best baseball team, the Cincinnati Reds, the big red machine in 75 and 76. And so that's part of my love for Cincinnati is when I was a kid, I loved the Reds.
What made you think you'd be successful?
I was somewhat audacious, I admit. I knew a little bit about soccer. I knew a little bit about politics. No. Knew a little bit about the business of professional sports from the Bengals.
So naivete served a purpose for
Yes. you. And so I wrote this plan, and long story short, the Bengals and the Reds, I took it to them. They had no interest in owning the team or having the team play in their stadiums. So I went up to the University of Cincinnati, and the president there, Santa Ono, was a visionary. I convinced him that this could be great for the University of Cincinnati, as well as great for the city, that we were going to bring a lot of new energy and excitement around the global sport of soccer. January of 2015, Carl Lindner called me. His family is sort of the first family of Cincinnati. They had previously owned the Reds. And he told me that his family loves soccer and he's been eyeing an opportunity and wanted to know if I'd be willing to partner with him. And he had me over for lunch that same day. And he and I shook hands and said, January of 15, we're going to do this together.
So definitely meant to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
A little bit of divine inspiration.
Talk to us about an essential ingredient in your philosophy and how you went forward. And that's not only community engagement, but neighborhood, immediate neighborhood engagement.
Yes. So we started up in Clifton at the University of Cincinnati. And then, of course, all the bars and restaurants in the area loved us because we were bringing 20, 25,000, 30,000 people for games in minor league soccer. The pivot point was after our first year, we quickly were invited to be a part of MLS expansion. So really, the neighborhood engagement then was warp speed, because working with Major League Soccer, who wanted us, wanted Cincinnati to join the league, but they wanted the stadium in the downtown urban core. And this site, the site of our stadium, is in a historic African-American neighborhood that has seen significant decline and disinvestment. It was a proud neighborhood, and then they decided to put the I-75. In the 50s, they're building the highway system, and they put I-75 right through this proud neighborhood.
It's amazing how across America that same thing happened. We talked about Tulsa earlier. It's just brutal.
Yes, and then the effects were brutal for the West End. Mm-hmm. I think prior city and federal officials decided that the West End would be where there would be a high intensity of low-income housing. And this was a middle-class neighborhood with lots of doctors and lawyers, mm-hmm. as well as, yes, some people who were struggling. But there was a mix in this neighborhood. And after 75, it just went down. I knew that in order to win the support from the city to build our stadium here, we were going to need the neighborhood. I dusted off my old politician shoes and went door to door.
You literally?
Literally knocked on doors. I had a couple people from the West End. One was a minister, has the biggest church, and he bought into the vision. And one was a youth football coach. And then we had a woman who owned a dance studio for the girls. And the three of them went with me, and I went door to door, talked to the neighbors about what our vision is, and we were going to be good neighbors. But I mostly just listened. Listen to what their fears were.
What were their fears?
They thought that we were going to knock down all their housing to build the stadium itself or parking, and that they were going to be relocated out of this neighborhood. That was their biggest fear.
And how did you sell them on an increase in quality of life of their neighborhood?
They said, we want nice things in this neighborhood. All the nice things shouldn't go to all the other neighborhoods. They wanted the opportunity for working at the stadium, to have jobs where they could earn a little bit of extra money. They liked the idea that more things would come along with the stadium.
Neighborhood serving businesses?
Yes, more retail. They would like a mini grocery here. There'll be some nice restaurants and coffee shops that they can walk to. And that is happening as we develop just north of the stadium. We own a lot of the land there now. We have built with the county and the city parking so that people aren't needing to park in the neighborhood as people feared. But at the end of the day, we did not just say, here's the development that we're going to do. We talked to them in these future-minded sessions. What do you want?
They felt a sense of ownership.
Yes, very in an organic way. Also, when we designed the stadium, this is a beautiful stadium.
This is brand new, pretty much, isn't it?
We opened in 2021, just at the tail end of the pandemic, built it during the pandemic, which was quite a challenge.
Yeah.
But the architects and construction crews met with a committee of residents of the West End. Mm. The people here designed the stadium with our architects. So they feel real buy-in. Mm-hmm. The games are largely on Saturday nights at 7:30. So it's not as if we're, you know, 9 o'clock and it's 11 o'clock and it's being super loud.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We try to schedule it in a way that's respectful to the neighborhood.
I'm just looking around. It's just such an incredible stadium itself. Up here you have the glassed in boxes.
Yes.
Talk to us about that
infrastructure. Soccer, unlike say the NFL, we gotta run on our own fuel, which means we don't get these large checks from the league from broadcast revenue or national sponsors. If we want to be successful here in Cincinnati, we have to make our own money. So we have double the number of private suites, double the number of club seats than the league average.
That along with ticket sales, those are your two primary revenue sources?
Yes, and sponsorships. Mm-hmm. We obviously sold the naming rights. This is called TQL Stadium. TQL is a logistics company here in town. We have sponsors like First Financial Bank, Mercy Health. So all of these great sponsors, Cintas, Procter & Gamble.
Wow.
Because we're good for the city. Mm-hmm. And so the companies know that we're doing something that's important for the city. It's added all this new energy. In the world sport of soccer, there's more people playing soccer on this planet than every other sport combined.
Wow.
We're only about 25 years old. The NFL is about 100 years old. The Cincinnati Reds, 150 years old. So we're still a young league. So people compare us to the NFL. And I try to say, they've had a two-generation head start on us.
Yeah.
We're still catching up.
Well, in America, soccer has been under the radar big time.
Yes. Well, I saw that, which is why I thought there was an opportunity to make this happen in Cincinnati and give my kids a hometown team and their kids someday. And you could see there was something happening. I saw NFL data that showed soccer was rising between 2004 to 2014, dramatic growth. And I thought there was an opportunity for Cincinnati to be ahead of the curve and beat out Charlotte and St. Louis and San Diego and Nashville, Miami. They hadn't figured it out yet, but Arl and I had figured it out.
So the year's 2020. Things aren't quite done. You're in the midst of everything. You never woke up at 2 a.m. with going, oh my God, what's going on?
I would say this. I don't lack for confidence. And and I knew that our business plan was going to work.
So you were?
I was 100%. But I want to acknowledge no one was prepared for the pandemic. I just noted, although the revenue is local, well, you know, if you're the NFL during the pandemic, you're still getting the national revenue because of TV. Major League Soccer, there is no national revenue. So in that year, there was no local revenue. So we had to go to our owners. We had to pass the hat in order to keep operating. We had to get approval from the governor and the state of Ohio to keep building the stadium. All of our staff were working from home. We didn't lay any staff off at all. We kept everyone on board. I mean, it was a very challenging, scary time. 19 years of the Bengals, and at that time, you know, 3 or 4 years with FC Cincinnati, nothing prepared me to lead an organization through the pandemic. But I tried to have a level of humility that we're just doing the best we can. We're learning as we go. But we tried to stay consistent to our values of wanting to be a family-friendly, inclusive club, a franchise that makes the community better, and to be a winning team to represent proudly this city.
What other ways do you engage with the kids today with the adjacent high school?
We have a futures program where students at Taft who have an interest in professional sports can work for us, and it's also a bit of an internship where we have speakers come and talk about, maybe it's our athletic trainer or scouting or analytics. And then also, of course, on the business side, sales, marketing, communications, finance and accounting. So we sort of try to give them a flavor of what a career, the many different careers in professional sports could look like. And maybe that inspires them that when they go to college. We're also starting a scholarship program through our foundation. We have the largest foundation in Major League Soccer. Through our FC Cincinnati Foundation, we are starting a scholarship program with the University of Cincinnati. And so some of these students would then be able to effectively go to UC for free.
Full ride.
Full ride.
Wow. That's really cool. Dovetailing back to the immediate neighborhood and how you engaged and loop them in and going forward, because you formed a little neighborhood association, right?
We did. So when I went door to door, and there was also a lot of public hearings, city hall, city council, as well as the school board. And at these public hearings, there was a lot of people showing up and speaking. And I sat there and took notes of what everyone said. And what I shared with my staff is there's two groups of voices. One group is just politically, ideologically opposed to us. They don't think this is a good idea to build a professional sports team.
Well, why? What would be the blowback?
Because they didn't think that it was a good thing for this billionaire-owned sports team to be imposing itself in this historic African-American neighborhood, a neighborhood that economically was quite poor. They just didn't like it. However, that was one group. And most of those people did not live in the West End.
Oh, interesting.
Then there was another group of people speaking. They were all from the West End. They weren't opposed. They were afraid.
What were they afraid of?
They were afraid of change. Change had never been good for the West End. A lot of people had shown up making promises, none of which were delivered. And so the only change that they had seen was bad change. I said, that's the group we're going to listen to. We're going to listen to them, and we're going to work with them. So we did a community benefits agreement, which we negotiated with the community council. And so things like over 70% inclusion in the construction of the stadium. So women-owned enterprises, minority-owned enterprises, small business enterprises. The people that work at the stadium at all of our matches who are making a few hundred dollars extra at each of the games. We started a soccer program called the West End Pride for boys and girls. They had never had soccer here. We give $100,000 in grants to different community organizations for programs or for things that they're trying to do to help the people in the West End.
And the neighborhood council.
So we had our architects meet with the neighborhood council, we called it the design committee, to help design the stadium. The feedback they gave us is reflected in how we built the stadium. Quieter on the neighborhood side, a little bit less so. The biggest entrance is away from the neighborhood. 75% of our fans come in opposite the neighborhood. That was very intentional from the committee.
So going forward, the neighborhood, a little naive, but a positive sense of ownership?
Oh, not naive at all, but loud, boisterous pride of ownership. When we were building the stadium, there were workers here. We had a program with the building trades so people from the neighborhood could sign up, get training, and then come and actually work on the site and then have a career in the trades. And when they would see me, they would say, "Hey, Mr. President, you know, I'm from the West End." And now when I'm working, you know, walking around for our matches, I've gotten to know a lot of the people from the West End.
That's right.
"Hey,
cool.
Mr. President, how are we doing tonight? We're going to win tonight." A lot of pride.
Yeah.
Our DNA is to make the community better. That's one of our three core values. I run this team like I'm the mayor of Cincinnati. If it's good for Cincinnati, we're going to get involved. We're involved in anti-violence initiatives. That's not usually the purview of a team, but we can lead, inspire, and unite the young people in our city and in this neighborhood to see a different future. We do that because it's good for the city. And I try not to ask anything of the city or the neighborhood that's not good for the city.
Soccer has been a true game changer for the city. Today, what, 22,000 seats?
26,000 is capacity. And we sell out pretty much every game.
Every game. So it's been a game changer for whole new sports fans in the city, right?
What's really neat about soccer is we have a lot of fans who maybe aren't big fans of other sports. We have our supporter section called the Bailey. They're the ones with the drums and the smoke and the songs. And a lot of them said they've never felt welcome in other sports because when they were in high school, they weren't an athlete. They were maybe in theater or in the chess club or in community service. And they don't feel like those other sports included them. But soccer, and in particular the supporters area of soccer, everyone's welcome. It doesn't matter if you're a big sports fan. People tell me when I say, "Have you ever been to a game?" Sometimes they say, "Well, I'm not a big soccer fan." And I say, "Well, then you should come because over half the building isn't a big soccer fan. They just like to have a good time. They like to be a part of something that's making the city better, that they can enjoy and be proud of."
That's so cool. Well, I'm going to come back and check up on you in a couple of years, but we're out of time.
Okay.
To learn more about your world,
fccincinnati.com is our website. We're on all the social media channels. I'm Jeff Birding, and I'm proud to serve as co-CEO and president.
Jeff, thank you so much. What a fascinating, illuminating morning. This is way cool.
I'm very blessed.
Yeah, me too.
Worst nightmare is chasing back to goal, running into your own net.
When the Emory Theater in the historic Over the Rhine district first opened back in January of 1912, it was considered one of only four acoustically perfect concert halls in the entire country. The Emory Theater, the upcoming home of the Children's Theater of Cincinnati, the nation's oldest, is presently undergoing a major restoration. When the curtain rises in the fall of 2025, it will debut with the latest inspirational technology, including a turntable stage lift, projection mapping, and a large video wall to dramatically enhance the audience experience. Come along and join Artistic Director Roderick Justice to discover the rest of the story. So where are we? Downtown Cincinnati?
Here in beautiful downtown Cincinnati inside the historic Emory Theater. My name is Roderick Justice, the artistic director of the Children's Theater.
And that was open
1911.
So it was state of the art when it first opened, wasn't it?
Oh, when Mary Emory was approached to help fund this structure, she wanted it to be a state of the art building of its time, the acoustics, the location, and I like to think that we are carrying on that same tradition that Mary Emory would want. She would want something that is state-of-the-art today.
And what was it purpose-built for? Was it concert?
Originally, it was built for the symphony, a place for live music. So there was limited space in the lobby. You go straight to your seat, you enjoy the performance, and you leave. So we are making a lot of adjustments to make sure that we bring our building into what we need today as a children's theater.
So that's what it's going to be?
Yes. The home of the nation's oldest theater for young audiences.
How cool. Mm-hmm. Let's go back in time. I remember reading a while ago that the acoustics of this theater, when it opened in 1911, blew people away.
Absolutely. That is why Mary Emery wanted the best on this project. The acoustics, it was considered one of the top three acoustically pure spaces for a long time. I don't know, it may still be considered one of the top three. Mm-hmm. But what we are doing, we had our acoustician come in and look at the space, listen to the space around our theater, and we're actually improving the acoustics.
Oh, wow.
From adding sound and light locks to the entrances to the curve of the plaster around the proscenium, which if you just angle it slightly, improves the acoustics.
What's fascinating is, as you know, acousticians today have monitoring equipment. They make little scale models. They suck the air out and put whatever hydrogen in.
Right.
Do all their model testing before they even construct. But back in the day, they didn't have that luxury, and yet they pulled it off.
And one of the first theaters that didn't have any obstructed views because it was built of steel.
Columns. No columns, yeah.
And it has this curved orchestra level and a curved balcony and then the arch over the proscenium.
So over the years, this theater did a multi-purpose usage, right? There were even movies that played here?
Yes, and it was the Children's Theater of Cincinnati's home originally. It began as a venue for the symphony, and over time, when the symphony went back to Music Hall, this space was used for a multitude of purposes, from the home of the Children's Theater of Cincinnati to showing old movies.
And at some point, it closed, right?
It did, and unfortunately, over time, it fell into an unusable state in certain areas of the building because it was not safe. Now we are not only bringing this building back to life, but we are improving it and making it accessible on every single level for everyone.
When was the vision and the decision made to rebirth the theater?
About 4 years ago, we sat down with some wonderful colleagues. They threw the idea out to us, and this was a pie-in-the-sky idea. What we bring to the table is we are the nation's oldest professional theater for young audiences.
So when it's rebirth and kids come back, will it be multi-purpose? Will other things happen here too?
Eventually, we would like this space to be a center for everything family-friendly. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be doing rock concerts at 9 o'clock at night, but we will have a vision to bring in different types of programming. So think about work that's being done in South Korea or Australia that is for the very young, theater for the very young or theater for young audiences that is touring around the United States. We would like to bring them in for a short stint, a taste of everything, a taste of theater around the world.
So the world comes to Cincinnati.
Absolutely.
Looping in the kids. That's so cool.
And making sure they're exposed to as many types of entertainment as possible. Mm-hmm. We really want to exercise their imaginations beyond what's in their backyard.
How do you harvest the kids from the schools?
So our talent is actually, that's a misconception because we are a professional theater. So we pay all of our actors. They come in and audition for us and it's age appropriate. Mm-hmm. So if we, for example, are doing Annie is a child. All of her friends, the orphans, are children. Daddy Warbucks, he's an adult.
Oh, that's so cool. And you're kind of like the choreographer, the brains, the glue that binds in this new iteration.
I often think about the Children's Theater Cincinnati as the human body. Our incredible president and CEO, Kim Kern, is the brain, obviously. I find that I'm maybe the nervous system.
ETA for unveiling.
Plan is to open in October of 2025.
Coming up.
It's coming up quickly. Yeah. Knock on wood.
That's so cool. Let's step forward in time. The curtain pulls back. What's your debut?
I don't know if I can announce the show yet, but I will say that when audiences come to this space, it is going to be an experience like nothing else they've ever seen. We'll have things happening inside the theater and not just at a distance on the stage. It's not to distract from the story, it's to enhance the story.
How does that happen?
Through the use of technology, we'll have lift systems. So imagine scenery, instead of coming from the wings, it's coming up from the floor, coming down from the sky through automated fly systems.
Talk a little bit more about, I know it's all Dreamtime future, but you're open and running. What sort of shows would you like to line up going forward?
I want theater that speaks to everyone, that is representative of our community. I want theater that inspires young people, that exercises imaginations, and no matter the title, whether it's the most popular title in the world or the most obscure title in the world.
Let's dovetail back to the kids local right here. How do you harness and engage with them through the schools and the school districts?
We are here because the arts in our schools are depleting, and we know this because we survey those schools. We exist to make sure that we're filling the gap that is left by the reduction of arts in schools. So for those students who are coming on their field trips with their buses, we're serving a purpose beyond just entertainment. We're providing an artistic experience that they will otherwise never have, and we're doing it at a young age that will help them get acclimated to being a lifelong lover of the arts.
Do you do reverse field trips where you guys go out to the schools?
We do. If you can't come to us, we will come to you. We have touring productions. They set up a pop-up set. Sometimes it's a one-person interactive show where the students actually get up on the stage and take on the characters with the storyteller. So we're very much impacting the schools that aren't able to come downtown. We're going to be able to still serve those who can't come to us.
So you're blessed.
Oh, beyond blessed. Mm-hmm. To be able to call this work is, I feel guilty.
Yeah, don't tell anybody.
It's an honor to be able to carry this torch.
So if somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
You can go to our website, thechildrenstheater.com, and explore everything that we have to offer.
And you got to be on Instagram, right?
Oh, yes. Our handle is TCT Cincinnati.
And Facebook, yeah?
Yep, we're there too, thechildrenstheater.com. And my name is Roderick Justice, the artistic director of the Children's Theater.
Roderick, what a great day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a delight.
I'm Alicia Kintner. I'm president and CEO of ArtsWave, the Cincinnati region's engine for the arts.
It's one of the premier arts organizations in the whole United States of America.
The leading local arts agencies and largest community arts campaign.
How did that happen?
Our history goes back to 1927, mm-hmm. when the Taft family of Cincinnati decided to leave its art collection to the people of Cincinnati, mm-hmm. along with $1 million, if the people of Cincinnati would show that they'd value such a thing by contributing matching dollars. And within 3 months, mm-hmm. in 1927, several thousand Cincinnatians had contributed $2.5 million, to which the Tafts added $1 million, wow. and created an endowment that exists today as ArtsWave.
That's incredible. Those are big numbers for that time.
Absolutely.
Quick aside, Taft is in President Taft?
Yes, that yeah? family, yes. Uh-huh. He actually accepted the nomination on the porch of the wow. family home, yes.
Here we are today, 2024.
Yes.
And you're still reinventing yourself post-COVID.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the arts were hit hard by the pandemic, really an industry that had to shut down overnight. And we're experiencing the same shifts in consumer behavior and how we access entertainment. But this is a community that cares about the arts. And every year, tens of thousands of people contribute to the ArtsWave campaign.
Everything is kind of fluid and,
yes.
and changing before your eyes, and even where you put on performance.
Yeah, that's a great point. One of the things that ArtsWave does as the primary arts funder is encourage organizations to get outside of their own four walls.
Symphony might get out of the symphony
hall. Yes, get out of symphony hall, perform in neighborhoods, perform in parks, perform at the Riverbank, places where in old days union musicians probably wouldn't want to go outside of the acoustically correct hall.
Yeah.
And for our museums as well. You know, they used to say, well, how do we take an insured piece of art mm-hmm. outside? And that, of course, isn't exactly the point. But as an example, the Cincinnati Art Museum, right before COVID, coincidentally, built what they called the Art Climb, which is 1,000 steps that connect the museum on the hill down to the busy street below. Mm-hmm. And it's covered with sculpture and art installations, and it's a great place to get your morning exercise.
Wow. Bringing the arts outside
again. Yes, yes. Connecting people that had never been up the hill mm-hmm. Now have a way and a reason to go there. And of course, our art museum is also free admission. We are very fortunate in Cincinnati that two of our museums, anyway, thanks to philanthropy, are able to be open free all the time to the public.
That is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then another evolution is bringing the art to people by going to the schools, from performance to artworks.
Yes. Arts education, unfortunately, is something that's often eliminated from curriculum mm-hmm. for all kinds of reasons. We are intentionally and strategically and systematically trying to ensure that every child grades 1 through 6 has at least one arts field trip every year, mm-hmm. district by district, so that it's equitable access to the experience and tied to the curriculum. In Cincinnati, we're fortunate to have professional arts organizations in really every discipline. So full-time symphony orchestra, top 10 symphony, the first encyclopedic art museum west of the Alleghenies, the Cincinnati Art Museum, classical ballet company, Cincinnati Ballet, opera company that is second only to the Met in New York City.
Wow.
In fact, the Cincinnati Opera was founded in 1920 because the originators and founders of the Cincinnati Zoo were worried that not enough people were coming to see the animals. So they went to New York and invited Metropolitan Opera singers to come to Cincinnati in the off season, so summer instead of fall, and sing in the zoo.
Wow.
And that is why to this day, the Cincinnati Opera season is in the summer mm-hmm. instead of the fall and winter. And up until the 1960s or 70s, our opera performed at the Cincinnati Zoo.
Do they ever come back and sing for
They
them?
Do.
Yeah.
They do. They perform in the zoo every few years. Yes.
That is really cool.
It is. Yeah. It is. And a little counterintuitive that we would bring opera singers so that people would come see the animals. Yeah.
A little bit more before we go. Cool things that you do. You know, it's like, again, what are the arts? It could be a puppeteer.
Absolutely. We have a puppet company called Madcap Puppets, so you put your finger on it. We have a vast network of neighborhood arts associations, arts centers that serve the neighbors around them mm-hmm. and do programming that is both for amateur artists, makers, but also bringing professional organizations into those neighborhoods. We have a huge network of amateur community theaters, a lot of thespians in town. We have a thriving and burgeoning film industry and are considered one of the best places in the U.S. to be a movie maker and make your career.
And that's because of your film commission, right?
We have a very active mm-hmm. commission, Film Cincinnati, that's been aggressive and intentional for several decades mm-hmm. in establishing Cincinnati as a great place for major motion pictures and commercials. And part of it is our architecture, which can look like many other cities mm-hmm. quite easily.
And then the riverfront.
And too. The river, we have really beautiful riverfront, huge collection of Italianate architecture and over the Rhine. It's a great place to be an artist and a great place to be an arts lover.
I love it. Anything you want to add before we go?
We'll be hosting the National Americans for the Arts Convention in June of 2025. So we'll look forward to welcoming people from around the country, local and state arts agencies to Cincinnati.
Okay, Alicia, to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Our website is artswave.org. We're also on Instagram and TikTok and Facebook, anywhere else you find your social these days, at Artswave. It's been great talking with you, Tom.
You too, Alicia. What a pleasure.
Great.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from Cincinnati, Ohio. Come along and join me for a visit with Ira Simpson Bush. She's the executive director of HIGWORKS Flying Pig Marathon. The marathon, ranked by USA Today as the number one best marathon in the entire United States in 2024, the Flying Pig Marathon is revered by runners and for good reason. It's fun, with pig motifs used everywhere, from the pig pen corrals to crossing the finish swine. The course runs through the most diverse and scenic neighborhoods of Cincinnati and surrounding townships and alongside the Ohio River. Last year, Cincinnati welcomed nearly 30,000 participants from all 50 states and 22 countries, making it the 13th largest annual U.S. running festival. The pig theme is unique to Cincinnati because of the city's rich history in pork processing. It earned the moniker Porkopolis way back in the 1800s, and thus the genesis of the name Flying Pig Marathon. Come along and join the conversation with the most ardent fan of the Flying Pig Marathon, Iris Simpson Bush.
Land of the flying pig.
Yes, where pigs fly and dreams come true.
I love it. And your name is?
Iris Simpson Bush.
And you've been involved in a marathon for a long time. You were involved in creating it?
I'd heard somebody was trying to bring a marathon to town. I happened to work at a local TV station. We offered our support to help promote it, and I was asked to be on the board. That was in August of 1997. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I did have the honor of being a part of the creative team, the late 70s. Nothing in Cincinnati, and part of the deterrent was our hilly terrain. Cincinnati's not your typical flat Midwestern town. In fact, we have seven hills surrounding us, and it is a challenging course. We're always the first to admit that, but when you do the pig, you get bragging rights. Like a lot of other marathons, you know, trying to weather the pandemic, it was a survival. Kept through it. We did it virtually.
Mm-hmm. How do you do a virtual marathon?
Well, people are on their honor system.
Yeah, no kidding.
People, you know, signed up. There were thousands who wanted to do it. Let's face it, during the pandemic, people were eager for anything that's outdoors.
Mm-hmm. And part of the myth, legend, and lore and why people want to come is the flying pig.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
You know, Cincinnati was known as Porkopolis. The late 1800s, they literally ran pigs through the streets of town. They were delivered at the riverfront. The stockyards and meatpacking industry was further up in town, so pigs ran through the streets. The running community in Cincinnati has always been very active, very prolific. Toyota, a longtime automotive sponsor, calls themselves the official rig of the pig. So our very name is conducive. The brand and having fun with the brand, we always say we put the fun in the run.
So people, some sign up for the marathon just to get the pig medal, right?
Absolutely. I cannot tell you how many times I've been told, well, I never really thought of coming to Cincinnati, but I came for this big fat pig butt on the back of the medal. And our response is always whatever it takes to get them here. Very proud of our hometown, and it's a great place to introduce people to a different part of the country.
When does the annual marathon take place?
We are always the first Sunday in May. For the first 2 years, we were on Mother's Day. After that, our past 24 years, the first Sunday in May. We have become a weekend running festival.
How many people do you draw?
Well, this year we had 39,000.
Wow.
Our record year was 43,667, to be exact. Yes, people have embraced the pig. They've embraced the idea of this weekend of events. A lot of times someone will come to run the marathon and bring family to do all of our events. We kick off Friday night.
What are the peripheral events?
We call them our ancillary events, and we have on Saturday a 10K, a 5K. We do an event for people with special abilities. By popular demand, we have the flying fur for people who want to run with their dogs, although a few pigs, goats, and other animals have shown up, but it's the flying fur. And then we have a youth program. It's an incremental run where we have about 5,000 children enrolled who will do their 25 miles the months leading up, couple miles a week. Mm-hmm. And then they get to finish on Saturday under the same finish the marathoners will be using. So it's really quite exciting for them.
And it's a greater good fundraiser, right?
Absolutely. We are a not-for-profit, a 501c3 ourselves, who raise money for other charities. To date, we're approaching $20 million that has been raised for a number of very worthwhile causes.
Do you have an anchor?
In the early years, Team in Training was the Leukemia Lymphoma Society was our primary. They just had a very good model for raising money. So many other causes and entities have now emulated that. We have all the big guys, you know, American Cancer Society. You know, we have Boy Scout, Girl Scout troops who volunteer for us. That's one of the ways our charity partners raise money. They bring volunteers, we write a check to their organization. That's been a model that, again, is now used in other marathons, but was pretty unique with us in the early years. For example, Flying Pig Weekend, we have a little over 8,000 volunteers helping to put on the weekend of events.
They get pig t-shirts?
Grunt shirts are, we affectionately refer to them as our grunts. Our spectators are squealers. We cross this finish line. The pig is just very conducive to all the puns. And as I said, we take our event very, very seriously. We have some very competitive runners. We don't pay prize money. We give a lot of swag. Mm-hmm. It's always been billed kind of as the every person's marathon. We attract a lot of first timers. We have competitors from all 50 states. This year we had 22 foreign countries represented, so it's grown incrementally through the year.
So USA Today does an annual Reader's Favorite Marathon.
Yes.
Where do you place on that one?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. They just did it this year, and the voting ran through April. 20 marathons were nominated. Their criteria, I'm not sure what it was, but they said we were carefully vetted. From the get-go, we were number one.
Wow.
The last week of the voting, you don't know where you stand. The New York Marathon came up very close, but we won out. Marine Corps was number three. I love that marathon, an excellent marathon. Big Sur, arguably the most beautiful course in the country along the coast in California. So we were honored, and it's something you strive for. You put all of your effort, your passion, your commitment into it, and no one was more shocked than we when we won.
Do you attribute that to the pig?
Absolutely. To the pig, the reputation, word of mouth. I mean, runners recommend to other runners where to go if you want to have a good time. And we've just been so fortunate to have people enjoy the experience we try to put on. And our uniqueness, I think, attracts people as well. Seven hills, just like the city of Rome. So our course includes a few of those. In the first 7 miles, you climb to a beautiful panoramic view of the river and the city. And then after that, it's pretty rolling.
So
but
is any downhill?
The half course gets their last 4 miles downhill, but the full, they don't get so much downhill. Obviously, if you go up, you have to come down, but it's very rolling and gradual. Mm-hmm. And they do have a flat course from about mile 22 on in.
Nice.
Yeah.
So they're forgiving you at the end.
A little bit. Yeah. They're so exhilarated to have done their own marathon, whatever their goal was. If you have a little bit of part of helping them achieve that goal, you celebrate their achievement.
And you're a veteran. You've run a few yourself, haven't you?
Myself, yes.
Yeah.
It's not an easy undertaking, but in the spirit of full disclosure, the half is my favorite distance. We have a local Thanksgiving Day race. It's the sixth oldest continuous road race in the country. I've done 39 of those to date. I've even missed some in between.
You have a lot of pigs on your wall then, huh?
Oh, yes. A lot of pigs, a lot of medals, and more importantly, wonderful memories.
That's so cool.
You can find us on our website, flyingpigmarathon.com. Mm-hmm. Our signature event is the Flying Pig Weekend of Events, first weekend in May.
And I'm sure you have some other social media.
Absolutely. Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. Well, it's now.
Yeah. Formerly
the new,
Twitter.
Formerly Twitter. But yes, on all the social media platforms.
The Flying Pig rules.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah. We do fly in Cincinnati.
All right. And I'm your host,
Tom Wilmer reporting from Cincinnati. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.